Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, it's been high drama here in the Washington Metroplex over the past week with the Speaker of the House subjecting himself and the House and the country to no fewer than 15 votes to secure his role as the Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, that is, and he is now that. And the question is, where do we go from here? And to talk about both his trial by fire, if you will, over the past week at the hands of people who have been described as, quote, extremists and insurrectionists, unquote, is a man with considerable firsthand experience with and knowledge of not just the House of Representatives, but Kevin McCarthy, among other things. His name is Steve King. He served with great distinction, I believe, for 18 years in the House of Representatives, representing the people of Iowa. He is truly one of the great conservatives of our time and is much missed in the House of Representatives at the moment, but we're delighted to have him on our program with some regularity now, and I hope that will continue to be the case in 2023. Congressman, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us.
Thanks a lot for having me back on, Frank. And I'd say to start out with this past week in the House, that is the time that I most wished I was in the middle of that arena. I've enjoyed my home life quite a lot over the last couple of years, but that time I'd have loved to have been in there with them all.
Yeah. Well, you were there for some of the preceding exercises of this kind, though none had this effect. And I want to get in a moment to the prospects for what came out of all of this. But before we do, just for our audience's benefit in particular, Steve, talk a little bit about what happened. Who are these folks? I call them the Terrific 20 and the Super 6. Would you characterize them as anything other than true blue conservatives?
Well, if I were going to do that, I would call them constitutional Christian conservatives, I think to a man or a woman, principled people that were elected into Congress with a conviction and a belief and an ideology that we needed to deal off of the moral values that are the foundation for our Constitution, and take us back to the Constitution. And I've just seen that time after time. And on top of that, really what they argued for was regular order. So these are noble warriors, and they knew, I put it out this way during the week, you 20 are standing on the trap door to hell, and if one of you steps off, you're handing the trip lever over to Kevin McCarthy. They stuck together until it just couldn't hold up any longer. And I know a little bit about that feeling, too, and maybe we can talk about it in a little bit, Frank.
Yeah. Well, I do want to in a little bit, but before we get there, they persuaded Kevin McCarthy over a period of time, 13 or so votes at least, that he was not going to be Speaker unless he accommodated himself to what I would characterize as a host of commitments that he basically should have been volunteering to do from the get-go. I mean, regular order is a term of art. Tell us what that means in practical terms and how it was manifested in this rules package and why it would be so hard for Kevin McCarthy to agree.
Regular order was what I experienced when I stepped on the floor of Congress in 2003 in January. And it's set up so that the will of the people can reflect through. And you need to be, as a single member of Congress, you need to be able to call a vote and hold people accountable for a position. If you serve your whole career in Congress and you can't even get a vote on your most important thing, you don't have regular order. So the most important people.
But just to explain that for a moment. You're talking about an inability under the irregular order that has become the norm to even offer amendments or have a process in committee on which you serve where you can do the same. Is that right on the floor?
And the committee is a little different, but on the floor, Chip Roy made this point that a regular rank and file member had not been allowed to offer an amendment on the floor of the U.S. House in 6 years. That means that also, if you can't offer an amendment, they're not moving your bills through committee. They're not allowing hearings in committee, and let alone not allowing markups. You can. I mean, I sat in committee even under that, and I was able to get amendments offered. They may be ruled out of order, but at least I could force a debate on something in committee. But the pressure against that is so great, I don't think many members are willing to do that these days.
Well, but beyond that, there's been this practice, as I think you said, that you don't even get a markup. The markup is done in the speaker's mm-hmm. office, and then it's just delivered to the floor as a take it or leave it.
To give you an example, Frank, I chaired the Constitution Committee, the subcommittee of House Judiciary Committee. I chaired that because they couldn't deny me a subcommittee, and I wanted to chair immigration. I used it, I think, well. But even chairing the Constitution subcommittee, Paul Ryan as speaker brought a constitutional amendment to the floor for a vote that took a two-thirds majority in order for it to pass without anything coming by in front of me. The only knowledge I had was just whatever showed up in the press. Just, here we go, here's the constitutional amendment all the way around me, which I'm sure they didn't want me to weigh in on a logical balanced budget amendment.
No, I'm pretty sure that was the case. It was a small miracle that you had a committee chairmanship, a subcommittee chairmanship to boot. But give us a sense of the composition of the House Republican caucus, because I think most people think this is a group that is representative. After all, that's what you're supposed to be, right? Representative of the Republican electorate, the base, if you will, of the party.
We would think that all the Republicans elected to the U.S. House of Representatives would be dedicated to moving the Republican platform, the national platform, and also the platform within their various states. Almost all of them have separated themselves from that at this point. And some of those reasons, they've reached, a disrespect. I want to stop short of using the word contempt, but a disrespect for the grassroots, rank-and-file people that are the very base. They take the base for granted. And then we've seen, as Kevin McCarthy spent millions of dollars to defeat conservatives in Republican primaries in order to shape that conference in his image. He's been doing that for several cycles now. This time it was the most stark. I don't know how many, but I'm going to say there's 10 or 15 of them at least that would be serving in Congress today if it hadn't been for Kevin McCarthy opposing them in a primary, all to get those to come in that would vote for him for speaker. That's why it was so close.
And that's one of the reasons why that was addressed in this rules package, that wouldn't be done going forward.
That's how I understand it. I just scanned the rules package, and I know that was part of, I understand that was part of the agreement. But as you said at the beginning, most all of that rules package is just regular order. The thing that anybody that's wanting to be a candidate for speaker could just simply say, yeah, I like all this. Let's go ahead and do that. Now let's talk about the things that we can do to advance our cause more effectively.
But it was at the expense of an all-powerful speaker. And at the end of the day, I guess it's fair to say Kevin McCarthy was dragged kicking and screaming to weaken the role of the speaker in order to reestablish regular order and create more accountability and give, as you said, individual members more of a say in the workings of the House of Representatives. And I can understand how painful it is for you not to be there to benefit from that, of course. But two things that in particular I just wanted you to very quickly comment on was, one is the idea that a single member can call for the vacation of the chair, as they say. And the other was that, as I think Chip Roy emphasized, there were some select committees created that, if given real authority, could do some very important oversight and investigative work that might make a difference, might really matter in this environment where as I'll be talking about more with Bill Walton momentarily, the Congress, the House of Representatives, can't do a whole lot more. I'm going to ask you to address those two points on the other side of this very short break. We'll be right back with the great Steve King right after this. We'll be right back.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last week, 20 true conservative legislators, not extremists, not insurrectionists, tenaciously negotiated an array of important changes for running the new Republican House of Representatives. In the end, 6 still declined to vote for the man who opposed many of these rules changes, but nonetheless allowed him to become Speaker. They did so out of a well-founded lack of trust in Kevin McCarthy, who ultimately prevailed because he reliably controlled some 200 other members of the new Congress. For example, last November he privately approved an omnibus bill that precluded Republican control over spending until September, but then publicly opposed it. We'll test Speaker McCarthy's trustworthiness today when his loyalists are asked to adopt the agreed rules package. Will the Speaker privately allow, if not encourage, some unconservative Republicans to vote down the package, even as he publicly supports it? This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back. Former Congressman Steve King, one of the veterans of previous speakers' races, and a man who has, I think, some very important insights from, again, hard experience with Kevin McCarthy, his character, his leadership, and why some members of the House of Representatives, 6 precisely to be fair, don't trust him. I asked you to just comment quickly before the break, Congressman, on 2 aspects of this rules package, and then we'll talk about its prospects. One, the corrective, going back to Thomas Jefferson's day, that a single member could force a vote on whether an individual should be removed from the Speaker's chair. And second, the idea that you will have, at a minimum, real, rigorous and unconstrained oversight and investigations by these various committees. Talk about those aspects of this package.
Well, as you referenced, the Jeffersonian rule is a single member can bring a motion to the floor, it's a privilege motion to the floor, and force a recorded vote to vacate the chair. And so that holds the Speaker accountable. It's the equivalent of a vote of no confidence in the parliamentary process, and that doesn't blow up the parliaments across around the world, and it shouldn't blow up the House of Representatives either, because if a single rogue member decided they would bring that motion every day, they could do that, but they would meet the ire of the other 434 in such a way that they might actually expel him from Congress if he's going to obstruct them in that way. You have to have the support before you can bring that motion.
But more to the point, even if you bring the motion, that doesn't guarantee that you're actually going to vacate the chair. As we saw, Kevin McCarthy had 200 absolutely locked in votes through all 15 of those various roll calls. So he may be somewhat more accountable as a result of this mechanism, but not necessarily actually imperiled in terms of his speakership, unless he betrays the trust of the
That's right.
Caucus.
And that would be the trust of some of the 201 or so that stuck with him. The others are going to be watching him very, very closely. And actually, they have the 20 that stood, that they actually have those votes to remove Kevin McCarthy if they can get together and do it. My argument that
And the Democrats would vote, go along with it.
All 212 of them every time, as we saw. Yeah. But I made this argument with them, though, that you made the point on policy and process. So we've got this in the rules package, most of the things they asked for. But they identified those requests to individual members. So that individual member went into the negotiations room and they said, well, you want policy X, say the motion to vacate the chair. Yes. And they say, okay, fine, now you have that. Go out of this room. You're on our side. And they picked them off one after another after another. I said, no, just say this is our package. Don't put anybody's name to it. This is the gimme that ought to be. It's a 6-inch putt in the arena. But you need to talk about character and hold that together. That is actually is the center of this. If they could have trusted Kevin McCarthy, they would have just negotiated and not held out.
Right. Well, this brings us to today's pass. I should just say the oversight piece doesn't seem to have made it into the package. And there's still a question as to whether the Speaker will allow subpoenas and witnesses and lines of inquiry. I'm particularly concerned, we'll talk more about this with Bill, about the China inquiry and whether we'll get into some of perhaps his own exposure to very dubious conduct with respect to funding the Chinese Communist Party's malevolence through Wall Street and Sequoia Capital. But I did want to reserve our time to talk with you as a practical matter. It's something that we'll know more about by the time this program airs, probably, but we're recording before the vote on this so-called rules package. Mm-hmm. Again, talk about both the process and the prospects for this package being approved by that 201 votes that Kevin McCarthy can sure deliver when he wants to.
Well, I'll make a quick reference also to what you've alluded to, Frank, and that is that if the committee chairs don't have subpoena power, if the speaker retains subpoena power, he can control every one of these investigative committees. And that means they won't have the witnesses that they want. It'll be tying down the committee. He tells the chairs what to do anyway. So that's a big problem. And then we've seen here over the weekend, as I'll say at least three of the very, very moderate Republicans that are in that conference that stood behind Kevin McCarthy make comments that they're not going to support this rules vote. It only takes one or two more, and the Democrats, as you said, will all vote together. The rules could go down. If they do, make no mistake, this isn't because Kevin McCarthy was defending the rules package that he agreed to. It's because he's back-channeled, given them a green light to bury the rules and defeat them on the floor. If he's successful in doing that, his fingerprints, in my mind, would be all over it. We're playing call shot right now. If that happens, Kevin McCarthy would have given back-channel license or orders for them to take down the rules vote. If they do that and they come back with the rules that are similar to last Congress's rules, then they will have nullified all of McCarthy's negotiations, and he will have defeated the 20 that stood on the trapdoor to hell.
This I call omnibusing, because as you know, in connection with the omnibus, he was for it before he was against it. He supported it. He helped engineer it, I think it's fair to say, in private. And then when the heat came up and these conservatives were raking him over the coals about it, he pronounced publicly that he opposed it. And yet I think there was a lot of that winking and nodding going on in that case. Well, tease this out. What happens if the rules package goes down? What do the 20 do now? And you know, is the chair vacatable at this point, or is there no rule that governs that? Is it the Nancy Pelosi inherited rule, or is it the Jeffersonian one, or none that's operating?
Some say that the rules from the previous Congress carry over, in which case it would take a majority of the vote to remove Kevin McCarthy as Speaker. I don't really buy that. But on the other hand, if
wait a minute, clarify that, sir. Yeah. It would always take a majority of the vote to remove him as Speaker. But the question is, can you bring a motion to vacate forward, and under what circumstances?
And under the Pelosi rules, it takes a majority to bring a motion to remove the chair.
To even bring the motion forward.
Yes.
Okay.
Then, of course, that majority is already there, so you could vacate the chair if you had whipped 218 on the same. That's impossible in this scenario, by the way. Which rule is going to apply? The historical Jeffersonian rule that says one member. I think that comes down to the parliamentarian. I can't sort this thing out through the history that would be applied to that and the parliamentarian. Who pays the parliamentarian? Well, it's not going to be the person that brings the motion to vacate the chair. They need to melt that place down if this happens. They should shut down every operation going on in that house. Any member can bring a motion to adjourn. And I would have those members standing there adjourning that house until such time as we had an agreement that the rules package was going to pass. Then I take those three, Don Bacon and Mace and the other one I've forgotten, and whoever adds to them, I would put the same heat on them that was on the 20 and then later on the 6. And I want to say something also too, Frank, before we run out of time. It's an important, I think, insight that very few of us are going to have, and that is when we found the 20 went down to 6, 7 and then 6, They were holding the line because they wanted to make sure the print of this rule was acceptable to the verbal agreement they made. That was fine, and it made sense. But then after that, they brought the pressure in. You saw nearly the fight take place on the floor. But when Gates finally went down, voted present, and then what it really was when you're in that place, in that pressure, it gets to the place where you're not going to win anymore, and it becomes about you. And when that washes into your being, into your consciousness, then your obligation is to, okay, swallow real hard and let this thing get over with, because you're not going to win. And if it's about you, it shouldn't be the fight to be carrying on any longer. And I've been there more than once.
I know you have.
Need to know that.
It takes courage even to get to that point.
It does.
And it's insuperably hard, I think it's fair to say, once you're at that point to continue soldiering on. Steve King, thank you for your insights into all of this. We'll be watching very closely what happens in the course of the day after this program goes into the can. We'll have you back on the other side to do a postmortem for
us
and figure out where we go from here. God bless you, my friend, and thank you for your service to our country, past, present, and prospective. God bless you. We'll be right back with Bill Walton, and we'll touch on this and China and more right after a short message. Stay tuned.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to one of our regulars here, I'm pleased to say, at Securing America. His name is Bill Walton. He is the host of his own television podcast program, The Bill Walton. A man who has great experience on Wall Street as a master of the universe, as they call them, Allied Capital's president. Also has served since he came to Washington as one of the leaders of our conservative movement as president of the Council for National Policy, which I'm proud to be a member. Bill Walton, it's good to have you with us as always. Welcome.
Frank, great to be here.
So we were just talking with Steve King about the prospects that the speaker's race may beget a race that will be underway as in a couple of hours. We'll be recording this, of course, before that, but the audience will be getting it after the votes. Tell us what you make of what's going on here on the rules package and whether the speaker's commitments will be welched upon out of the gate.
Well, even though the mainstream media and, in fact, a lot of Republican establishment tried to characterize what the 20 were doing with this blocking of Kevin McCarthy, in fact, they were doing a lot of good. And they had a very, very interesting agenda. A legislative improvement agenda, a process agenda, which sounds boring, but it's not. Just recently, 2 weeks ago, we had an omnibus bill passed, $1.7 trillion. That little inside baseball, typically that omnibus bill would have been 12 separate bills back in the old days, which allowed people to debate and negotiate on each of those sub-items. Instead, this was rolled into one, which has been the case in recent years. What the 20 demanded was that we go back to regular order in the sense that we'd have 12 separate bills during the year, and we Americans would get to see what people are voting on. They also asked for something outlandish. They want 72 hours to read bills before they're asked to vote on them. Well, that's a simple one. That was in the package, and then a lot of other procedural processes that allows more openness and democratic debate inside of Congress. And while some people can quibble over their tactics, I think they got a lot accomplished. What we need to worry about today is when Kevin McCarthy rolls out the rules package, is he going to do and propose what he will propose it, but will they get the vote to pass this? And some people believe, and I guess I count you and me among the skeptics, is that he's not going to have the votes, surprisingly. And so this thing will fail. And
well, as we talked about with Steve, the fact that the guy exercised such iron discipline over the 200 or so of his supporters over 15 votes suggests that he has some sway with them. And if they begin defecting now, I'm wondering whether it's with his approval.
Well, today will be an interesting litmus test to see whether he wants to follow through. We shall see. But I might remind on an historical footnote that I'm sure everybody remembers Magna Carta 1215, when the barons in England came to King John and said, you've been a despot. We want you to do these things to become less despotic. And he ended up signing the document that was supposed to be a major victory for democracy, or the beginning of it. What's the footnote, as Jonathan Turley reminds us, is that King John promptly went to the Pope and had it annulled. And so he signed it in July of 1215, but it was annulled in August of 1215. Let's hope today is not the Pope annulment day.
Well, let's hope so indeed. Bill, let me pivot to China. One of the things that I have to say I've been concerned about this speaker is his ties to a very prominent outfit, not on Wall Street, but that does a lot of hedge funding and the like out of Menlo Park, called Sequoia Capital. Sequoia Capital has, under Neil Shen, its founder, a very sizable fund called Sequoia China. And according to a report in the Financial Times back in July, this fund has some 900 companies it's invested in China, most in the deep tech sector. That is to say, a very strategic sector. And as you know very well, the Chinese are very aggressively trying to pursue dominance in things like artificial intelligence and robotics and the like. And that's where Neil Shen is raising money for these guys from American investors and others. And what's really worrying is that this is after he's already done some significant damage by helping fund TikTok, which we know is a weapon used by the Chinese Communist Party against our kids, and DJI, a big drone manufacturing outlet, which we now know is also being weaponized against us. To the extent that the speaker has ties to guys like these, are we likely to see, in your estimation, that we'll get in a China Select Committee proper oversight of what these guys are up to and the danger that they represent? Not just Sequoia Capital being just one example. We could go to BlackRock and Vanguard and Fidelity and others as well.
Well, I think this is an illustration of the problem we have, Frank, in defending America's interest against China's predations. You know, for decades now, Silicon Valley has been encouraging investors from China to invest in their funds. And in turn, they've invested in enormous amounts of capital, billions of dollars in tens of thousands of tech companies in China. And of course, the staffing of the venture capital funds in Silicon Valley is not exactly it's a lot of Chinese, a lot of East Indians, a fair number of people who are, I'm sure, you know, tremendous Americans, but yet they are divided loyalties there as to if we get into a fight with China, whose side are they going to play on? And it you know, you think about venture capital investments, it's very hard to unwind that in a short time. And the problematic piece,
unless something like a war interposes itself, in which case you may lose a lot of money right quick. You know,
the problematic piece is that the venture capital community has not come out strongly in these recent initiatives that we've been pushing to disengage from China, particularly with strategic industries. They've got too much money at stake and too many returns they're hoping to get.
To me to be charitable, Bill. I think if anything, they're out strongly opposing any restrictions on such investing. No,
well, certainly behind the scenes, certainly in the lobbying they're doing, that's the case. Yeah.
And that's what, again, worries me so much about this, is that one of the things that the House of Representatives is going to hopefully do is real oversight. They can't do so much on legislation for obvious reasons. It has locked itself into a budget until September. But what we're looking at and hopeful of is that we'll see some serious investigations, including, you know, what Hunter Biden has done with his family, including Joe, with the Chinese, including what Wall Street is doing, what including elite capture more broadly has entailed. And this is really, I think, important for us to get our hands around, because, among other things, we're watching the Chinese really ramping up. And you have a story you wanted to talk a little bit about, I think. They're slowing down investments where they don't want them, and they're accelerating them where they do, and that's a problem.
Well, as you know, we've been very, I think we've been very effective in shutting the U.S. capital markets to Chinese companies, whether with rulemaking or just the publicity. And they've raised very little capital in the U.S., but that has not stopped them from raising capital in the Chinese market, Shanghai and Shenzhen, et cetera. And they've raised about $87 billion in 2022 with roughly 480 companies, most of them tech companies. And part of that is that the Chinese Communist Party has told companies, if you're not in an industry we favor, you're not allowed to do an IPO. So a lot of more mundane companies, you know, consumer products companies, alcohol distilleries are on the so-called red list. And if you're on the red list,
in this case, it is not a good thing.
It's not a good
red
thing.
Red China.
You want to be on the green list. It's the same right. color code they use with their vaccine passports.
They're
fond of those colors.
Yeah.
And red has
a different connotation for most other applications in China.
So they're engaging in strategic, you know, in industrial management. They're trying to steer capital to, quote, favored industries. It never works because they really don't know enough to make those decisions. The markets are always a lot wiser. And so it's another case where China, in interest of gaining control, I think, is going to lose some of its entrepreneurial zest. And I think you know that Jack Ma just lost control of his company. That's been a longer ordeal, but that's part of a larger effort they've done to crack down on the tech billionaires in China. And they're still feeling the heat, and most of them expect to lose their fortunes.
Yeah, well, if not their lives, I suppose that's another option. Bill, I just have a corrective. It seems to me that if you look at the sweep of history here, an enormous amount of money has migrated from Wall Street to China. By some estimates, as much as $6 trillion. I think what you're saying is in 2022, for reasons, some of which may have to do with our tightening things up or just getting down on China, but I think it also had to do with the fact that the markets, as you talked about, have their way. $2 trillion was lost in China, which I think discouraged a lot of American investors from heading there, no?
Well, I'm only talking about the IPO market, initial public offering, Frank. And then
but also
about
recent
exchanges. That's just in 2022. But just because a company goes public in Shanghai doesn't mean American investors aren't buying it.
We're out of time, Bill. I got to go. Thank you, my friend. God bless you. We'll talk with you again soon. We'll be right back with more right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. We're back, and I'm very excited to have a conversation with our next guest. His name is Matthew Tierman. He is a man with an extensive background in financial matters, but he has been a freedom fighter part-time in the past, and now seems pretty much full-time. He is devoted to what is going on at the moment in Europe, from whence his family hails, Poland specifically. But he's also found time to focus on a part of the world that, unfortunately, too few of us have been paying attention to for far too long, namely Latin America, specifically the nation of Brazil. And with developments in the past day or two, I wanted to catch up with Matt and take stock of what is going on in Brazil and what might be the implications of it, not just for the people of that nation, important as it is, but for the region and for our vital interests in what I think of as our front yard as well. Matt Tierman, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome. I know you are sleep deprived. You have been commenting everywhere about this, and I'm so appreciative that you're doing it here at Securing America. We're glad to have you back, sir.
No, thank you for having me. I always love being with you, Frank. You know, we've known each other for so many years and are so in the same battles, arm in arm. So.
Amen. So level set for us, Matt. Remind us of what happened in the recent election, Bolsonaro's purported defeat and the repercussions of it.
Sure. Bolsonaro was up for re-election, first round October 2nd, second round October 30th, if nobody had a simple majority after the first round. It did end up in a runoff with Lula da Silva, the previously convicted president, two-term president, who was impeached and convicted and sent to prison, which is a very important facet of this drama, because his judicial appointees let him out of prison and annulled and vacated his sentences and judgments and then expunged his record so that he could run again, which already sets up the entire schema of gross corruption, of unconstitutionality, the judges that he appointed have, since he has appointed him and his successor, Dilma Rousseff, have appointed the overwhelming majority of the Supreme Court and their subsidiary court, the Electoral Court. They have created a judicial autocracy. They've created, in a constitutional republic in the modern era, thanks to the American model, most constitutional republics have separated powers between the three major branches, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. Well, in Brazil, that has been grossly set out of whack in recent years, as the judiciary has taken more and more power and legislated from the bench and given themselves enforcement powers, investigative powers, prosecutorial powers, sentencing and adjudicatory powers. And they basically went and put everybody in prison or sanctioned them in other ways, censored them, deplatformed them, froze bank accounts, house arrested. And this is journalists, this is protest leaders, this is activists, and this is even electeds. Multiple electeds in recent months have had their social media profiles wiped away by fiat of this this out-of-control Supreme Court, this tribunal led by a guy named Alexander de Moraes, who very importantly is also the chief justice minister of the subsidiary court, the Electoral Court, which administers and oversees the election and adjudicates any disputes springing from the election.
So what this could possibly go wrong? It sounds like a perfectly rigged game.
And as I said in one of my articles, they gave themselves so many powers, even Mugabe would have blushed. This would be like in the U.S. if one body was comprised of who worked together to ferment whatever politics they wanted. Eric Holder, Loretta Lynch, Gerald Nadler, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Merrick Garland, local prosecutors, heads of police, head of Christopher Wray. If you put them all together, you would have what the Brazilian Supreme Court now is, which basically has every power and nobody checks them. And the Constitution has a clause that does allow checking in a separated power dispute, which is Article 142. And that's what the hopes of the protesters, who for now 70 days, but really the 60 days from the moment the final tabulation was completed on October 30th, and I use that final tabulation in quotes, Biden said it was fair, free, and credible elections, moments after the final ballot was counted, with no oversight, no IRI, International Republican Institute, took a look and said anything. And there were many petitions, including the military. Their first role is to petition the court for the ability to do the audit. And the court basically said pound sand. They ignored the military when the military said, we want the machines, we want the data.
Just drill down on that. What exactly is the constitutional authority of the military in this kind of disputed powers arrangement?
So the Article 142 clause says that if there is a destabilizing dispute among the powers, it's up to the military to adjudicate it. And this is especially germane in a judicial dispute because it's the judiciary that adjudicates everyone else. You know, but who judge? It's like, you know, we always say, who watches the watchmen? Who, you know, who fact checks the media? Who judges the judges? And I mean, I was on a Twitter Spaces yesterday with a bunch of lefties who said, well, you know, it's the judges have there's a joke, they can make the final mistake. Well, their entire Brazilian democracy hinges on their final mistake. And if that mistake is by design, is a feature, not a bug. Yeah, there are some impeachment mechanisms within the legislature. But if the legislature is captured, then what? You know, you can lose your democracy quickly.
The military had a role and elected not to exercise it? Is that
so? There was a lot of movement in the days coming first to the certification, at the end of the certification when the crime was completed and they certified their own fraud. Then there was rumors and murmurings and that Bolsonaro was in conversations with the high command of generals. That's about a dozen or so generals that oversee each branch of the armed forces, from the Navy and Air Force and Army and Marines and Coast Guard and National Guard. And many of them, I know from my sources on the ground, did side with Bolsonaro, but there were few who were very captured already by Lula, including Frere Gomez, who is the integral general to this sort of action, the army. And he just totally punted. And as a result, they did not. And Bolsonaro said, hey, I don't want to have my fingerprints on a civil war, which I think, given his many vocal statements for years, that this would end one of three ways, his arrest, his death, or his victory. He never included the fourth alternative, which is he flees to Disney, which is what he did. And as a result, the Brazilian constitution has been grossly eviscerated. And probably Brazil as a constitutional republic is over unless the military acts and fights the court in a hot kinetic battle, which is tantamount to civil war. Then there is no constitutional republic left in Brazil. It's Venezuela, which was the goal, by the way. That
this
was the design of the forum.
Hold the thought. Venezuela is where we're going to come back to. We're talking with Matthew Terman, an expert, among other things, on freedom. And when it's imperiled, he raises the alarm. And that's happening in a vital country of our own hemisphere, Brazil, as we speak. We'll talk about what specifically went down with rioting inside the capital right after this. Welcome back. Matthew Termond is in the House virtually. We're always pleased to catch up with him. We are doing so at a particularly important moment because in the space of the past day or so, there has been, well, some would call it an insurrection inside Brasilia, the capital of a vitally important country in our hemisphere, Brazil. And we've been talking about the run-up to these events. Now we're going to talk about what went down and at whose hands. Matt, what can you tell us about the events on the ground in Brasilia and who was instigating it and who may be held responsible for it?
Certainly. Well, you know, we've had 70 days of 70 plus now, 71, 72 of protests, millions of people. The revolution would not be televised. These are the largest, I've made the case, the largest manifestations of human protest activity in any constitutional republic in human history. The only thing that I think comes close on a nominal basis or a per capita basis is toward the tail end of the Soviet Union, when you had half of Estonia in the Singing Revolution and solidarity in Poland and so many in Russia. And that was major numbers. But maybe on a per capita basis, you know, I think we've had up to tens of millions, the measure of tens of millions across all the cities in Brazil for months now. And nobody in the global press would cover it at all, would mention it. And nobody in the Brazilian press, they would actually, because if you think our press is bad, the Brazilian mainstream press is even more brazenly dishonest. If you think, you know, fiery but peaceful protests out of MSNBC is pretty disgusting and reprehensible, dishonest media behavior. Well, Globo, which is like the CNN of Brazil, they would go to an abandoned back alley and say, see, there's nobody here. There are no protests. I mean, this is like right out of Pravda. It is absolutely Soviet in its methodology and mechanics.
But that's not an accident, comrades, as they used to say. Talk a little bit about, you know, the regime that is bringing this about as it bears on what actually took place in this particular window.
So, you know, these protesters are peaceful, prayerful people. There's been no violence, no arson, no cars flipped over. The only time there was a modicum of physical strife was after the certification, when those that the protesters proved to be Antifa types came down from the hills and did a false flag, set some cars on fire of the protesters, by the way, with Brazilian flags and Brazil with stolen stickers and stuff like this, set a bus on fire. And then, of course, that's when the mainstream global press said, see, the Bolsonaristas are causing trouble. Well, that went on steroids yesterday. There was tons of people in a widely telegraphed manifestation. They were planning to march as a Sunday. That's when people protest. They went to Brasilia en masse, those people who were already camped there outside the barracks, plus people from all over the country. And they marched in the center of the country amongst the buildings, the National Congress, the Supreme Court, and the Presidential Palace. And they did enter them. They saw empty buildings. I don't know if they were pushed. I don't see any Ray Epps-like figures. I think they're just so angry, and it's such a tinderbox. There were already, I have seen videos of known leftist activists who are already destroying property physically, breaking windows, stealing chairs, this kind of stuff. But, you know, you've got this data point of 70 days of peaceful protest. And then when you see a little bit of violence, you know, that jumps out as what in this pattern is different. And of course, now it's being used for a clampdown. You'll get a kick out of this. Lula gave an impromptu press conference wearing, you know, a Cuban style cigar roller shirt, man of the people. Very, you know, the optics are always strong, whether it's five pointed stars or hammers and sickles. And he said that, you know, these fascist thugs, these Stalinist thugs. And then he stopped himself with his throat. He said, well, not Stalinist. Fascist, though, which is funny because it's like he realized, oh shit, we like fascists. We like Stalin.
Stalin's a good guy.
Yeah, like this, you know, like Chavez and Maduro, who he incubated in the Forum Sao Paulo. You know, these are features, not bugs. So they're clamping down. Marias, the Supreme Court judge, has told the military they have to clear out the protesters. They're not going to do that. The local, the federal police who report to him are trying to do that. And there is a standoff now with the military. We'll see how that escalates. I don't know how it'll play out, if the military will comply. Marias has also threatened to fire generals. We know that's coming already because Lula has stated even before the turnover that he was going to replace the generals with his people. Maybe some of the generals did not bend to the Article 142 push for that reason. They wanted to retain their jobs. That's, you know, a little bit of conjecture, but reasonable, I believe.
Sounds right. Yeah. So, Matt, we've got evidently still some of these buildings occupied, and the police are trying to extricate them. And
I believe the buildings have been. The buildings have been vacated, both organically and through a modicum of National Guard pressure. There hasn't been any real violence. I think they started with rubber bullets. There was only one incidence of live ammo and somebody, a protester who was there, got shot in the leg. There are videos I've seen of that and Instagram, but kind of walked it off. These Brazilians are very hardy folk. So I do, you know, have faith that if they want to engage in this battle kinetically, it will be very, very ugly for those who they believe stole their democracy and their sovereignty and eviscerated their constitution. Not like, you know, Canadians who kind of rolled over in Ottawa pretty quickly.
Bolsonaro is being blamed for having armed the population, among other things.
Actually, so am I. So is Bannon. So is Jason Miller. I mean, the mainstream media is asking questions. How much were they paid to orchestrate a coup? And by the way, this is not about Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro's at Epcot. Bolsonaro's in Orlando in exile. I believe he's going to head to Italy, which will give him safe harbor, because they're going to do what they always do. They're going to trump up charges. And this is what communists always do. And not just in Latin America. This is what they've done to Misha Saakashvili in Georgia. This is what they've done to Gruevski in Macedonia.
But talk a little bit about this, because this is the context that I know is animating your concerns and mine. If Brazil is indeed gone, I think it's accurate to say that every major nation in the Western Hemisphere is now in the hands of Marxists.
Yeah, yeah.
Our own included.
Yeah, and working closely with China. China's thrilled. And you know, the Lula and Dilma were impeached and convicted because they were selling state assets to Chinese concerns for cash bags.
And the Chinese were very evident in the inauguration and post-inauguration window, weren't they not?
Yeah, so the so Xi's vice premier, who many believe is the true visionary power, I can't pronounce his name. Bannon and Posobiec are quite good at it, but they're more expert at than I am as a China watcher.
I think
something like that. I mean, China. He was invited to represent China, and that's like a guy above Xi. It would be like a party head in a parliamentary who controls the entire system. He was invited. He's the architect of One Belt, One Road, of the New Silk Road. He's the architect of the long-term strategy of China to take over the world and become the imperial global hegemon, spreading, you know, it's not Soviet Union anymore, spreading workers of the world unite, it's China. And Latin America, you know, that we've talked at depth about Foro Sao Paulo, they have been the incubator since Castro and Lula created in 1990 to replace the gap, the vacancy left by the death of the Soviet Union, funding Cuba and these revolutionaries.
And they're hard at it. Matthew Terman, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I trust that you will be staying on top of this. I know you will, and I trust you will be coming back to us very soon with updates. This is a high drama moment and a whole lot of stakes right on it. Thank you, my friend, for this report.
My pleasure.
Keep up the great work. Travel safe and Godspeed. Thanks to all of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us protect this country we love, and that you will now go forth and multiply.